is not concerned nearly as much with the nature of deity as with the primary problem of what was called the fall of man and the problem of the regeneration of man. Now, dealing with this entire subject psychologically, as they did not conceive the fall of man to be the result of a curse or of some evil doing. They considered the fall of man to be primarily caused by innocence. In other words, just as the small child finds itself in difficulties and is unable to orient itself or extricate itself because of its own immaturity, it was inevitable that souls, once they had an individual existence, would move towards and verge to involvement in elements and conditions which they did not and could not control. Thus, as the universe is an infinite diffusion of conditions, souls having an individuality immediately were moved to experiment with these conditions, following the same instinct that we have today, that the unknown is an endless temptation and an encouragement towards adventure. Plotinus describes individual souls as suspended like effulgent blossoms from the body of the world soul. And he declares that these souls, falling into generation, like seed falling into the earth, cause to generate around themselves the forms which are later to become their bodies. And just as the body of the plant grows from the seed, so the body of man grows from a primordial seed, which is the soul. And it is no more difficult to explain how the soul of man shall cause the body to come forth from it than it is to explain how the acorn can cause to come from it the great oak tree. Actually, bodies are built from soul seeds, and these seeds are sown in space. And these individual soul seeds, the moment they begin to build bodies, pass toward evolution, or pass toward an ultimate state of re-identification. All bodies are extensions of the soul toward unity. The fact that we have hands and feet are not primarily for the convenience of the body, but in order that the soul within the body may attain expression or release. And all release is toward re-identification with the world soul. Thus, the moment the seed is planted in space, at that moment the journey home begins. The journey home does not begin when the individual decides to be good or wise. The journey home begins with the atom, with the electron, with every form of life, conscious or unconscious. The mineral is journeying home the moment it forms its crystals. The plant is journeying home the moment it sends down its root or causes its first small shoot to rise through the earth. All things start home the moment they start releasing. And the release of the psychic energy in the formation of body is the beginning of this long way back to our own far distant native land. Thus, Neoplatonism is essentially a doctrine of the redemption of the human soul. But it differed from Christianity in the fact that it did not include any messianic dispensation or any power outside of man as contributing finally to the release of the soul. Neoplatonism did not believe in a fallen humanity, therefore did not believe in a redeemer, any more than it would have accepted a redeemer for the wheat that is cast in the earth and will bear its harvest tenfold. The natural growth of life is inevitable, was an assumption by which their entire concept was motivated. And this assumption was rooted in very abstract conceptual ideas concerning the nature of primordial being, which we cannot attempt to go into because they involve not only many mystical speculations, but a great deal of advanced mathematical formula. So we must contend ourselves with the simple thought that Neoplatonism is therefore a story of man's growth. And as a story of growth, is also a discipline of growth. Now in the problem then, we have again Proclus pointing out certain elements of the Platonic philosophy, which led to a further division between Neoplatonism and other systems growing up in the society around it. One of these was that the entire emphasis in Neoplatonism being upon the release of soul through and from body, and with the complete purpose of life vested in growth alone. Neoplatonism had very little time for the expanding and spreading of economic, sociological, industrial ideas. It was not concerned to any great measure with the extent of man's terrestrial domain. It would never have inspired exploration. It never would have led to this great rise of modern nations, such as we know, with their intensive competitions, their vast mortal projects. It would never have produced a civilization of individuals highly conscious of the wealth factor. It would not have produced these things because these people were not of this mind. Here again was one of the reasons they did not survive. They were out of tune with the most natural instincts with which man at that time and in future time also has been invested. But in Neoplatonism, the entire project deals with the actual release of the individual. When accused of selfishness and being self-centered, they replied that to their minds, their policy was by far the greater good, inasmuch as the only security that man can know in the material world is a security based upon an enlightened civilization in which each individual is doing right. Under such condition, wrong cannot exist. Therefore, the individual who devotes his life to the restoration of his own essential nature, if he increases in number and multiplies and becomes a dominant class in society, nearly all of the false ambitions of men will gradually be overcome. They can only be overcome when they are conquered within the individual, and not by legislation or by the collective growth of society, because there can be no growth of society that is not sustained by the growth of the individual. So they held a very strong and definite attitude on this matter. Now it would follow from their thinking that they derived much comfort from other philosophies, including certain phases of Persian mysticism, Hindu philosophy, Buddhism, Greek and Egyptian metaphysics. All of these subjects contributed to the broad pattern of the Neoplatonic concept. And in this concept, we gradually see emerging what they might term their way of life, their way of truth. And perhaps this way of truth was stronger than St. Augustine suspected, and not nearly so uncertain as he is inclined to imply. Neoplatonism definitely did have a systematic order for growth. This order for growth was based upon the great laws of analogy, which they held to be very important, the relations or similarities between man and the universe, and between individual soul and universal soul, individual body and universal body. All these analogies became involved in their disciplines. They began by assuming and affirming that men gather together or live together at this time in a state of common benightedness, and that exceptions to this benightedness are rare, almost unique, and only a few true exceptions exist in any century. And they held that the exception should be the rule, and that the only reason why the exception existed is because some individuals, for one reason or another, and they believed in rebirth, did achieve to a greater sincerity of intent and purpose. and that any exception to the general ignorance was clear indication that any and all other individuals could also be exceptions. That man possessed within himself a potential which could be redeemed and regenerated. And that until man recognized that this was his primary task, he would never achieve permanent security, peace, or enlightenment. And for this common state in which men live together, the Neoplatonists had the term opinion. And they considered opinion to be the lowest form of man's psychic life. And that by opinion, all men are commonly burdened, either by their own opinions or by the opinions of others. And what are opinions? Opinions are parapsychical growths. They are concepts which have no validity, having no source in reason or in judgment, arising not from knowledge, but from lack of knowledge. Therefore, a certainty arising from lack of knowledge is called an opinion. A certainty arising from lack of knowledge may be the most certain of all certainties, and there is no individual who is willing to defend realities more industriously than the opinionated are willing to defend their opinions. Now, why is an opinion wrong? What is there about an opinion? An opinion is a judgment passed without due examination. An opinion is a conclusion based upon appearances and not upon substances. An opinion is an immature, ill-defined situation. And it is also the product of an individual degree of non-intelligence which does not justify an individual arriving at a conclusion. Now, if everyone had to have a license and pay $5 a year for the privilege of having an opinion, we wouldn't have so many of them. But opinions are free, and we are very free with them. And yet, actually, it requires just as much wisdom to have a worthwhile opinion as it does to make an adequate diagnosis of an ailment. Therefore, we should go to school, perhaps do a postgraduate, and then a clinic, before we are entitled to have an opinion. And we are not entitled to have any opinion on any subject which we have not specialized. Therefore, when they made poor old Luther Burbank come down from Santa Rosa and make his opinions on theology because he was a great horticulturist, we have the tragedy. Namely, that a person is famous, his opinion on all subjects is supposed to be important. When he has no valid opinion outside of knowledge. And most of our troubles, opinion one form, gossip another, criticism another, arise from this condition which Heraclitus so well called the falling sickness of the reason. Opinion. Now, opinion to the Neoplatonists meant even more than this. It meant a level. It meant a world living only upon superficial observation of phenomena. An opinion would cause a man to say that the sun sets in the west because it appears to. Opinion is again to be measured in the term of Plato's allegory of the cave, where all the men down below who had never looked over the edge were quite certain of what existed there, and then proceeded to persecute the only man who went and looked and came back and told them. But because his findings were different from their opinions, he was wrong. Opinion, therefore, represents always a majority attitude. Because according to Plotinus, on such levels, the majority must always be wrong. The opinions of the majority, however, must not be confused with the intuitions of the majority, because that is quite different. But opinion is this superficial type of attitude or approach by which, as they expressed it, all things are held in common by exchange, but not by factual knowledge. Therefore, when we say something and affirm it because we have heard it, read it, or been told it, we are passing on an opinion. Now, an opinion usually in Neoplatonism does not apply to a phenomenon that is generally shared by men. Men do not have too many opinions about the fact that water is wet, nor do they have too many opinions about day and night. Opinions, therefore, are most dangerous where facts are the least available. Consequently, most of our most complicated opinions are on levels where together we do not share any adequate factual knowledge. And the moment we attempt to come to a conclusion beyond our knowledge, we fall into opinion, unless we are trained, and by training have learned how to extend the known reasonably and rationally. Now, above opinion and superior to it is sense. Now, sense to the Neoplatonists conveyed what we might term common sense, a very rare commodity, but one which is invaluable. Common sense has been held to be certain apperceptive or intuitive realizations that we share. Common sense is the expression of subjective experience. Anything that we have gone through ourselves, anything we have done ourselves, or anything we have thoroughly, rationally digested ourselves, may become available to us from the subconscious under the general form of sense. It therefore is that faculty by which primitive people are able to achieve an amazing validity in conduct or in the solution of problem. Sense is the individual solving or approaching an issue on the level of his own intelligence, but with all available, observable elements considered. Sense may not infer greatness of reflection, but it does infer breadth of observation and the ability to estimate the relationship of things seen to other things, which may not at that moment be apparent. Therefore, it is association. It is the continuity by which we learn from moving one stone, how to move many stones, and how from hollowing out a log to make a boat, we can gradually and inevitably move until we can create a great ocean liner like the Normandy or the Queen Mary. These motions are the gradual extensions of common sense. They are the individuals building upon the foundations of the achieved and moving toward that which must yet be achieved. This also, however, lies on the level of matter, very largely, and material things. But common sense also becomes the second level of philosophy, because common sense produces the homely, practical, natural philosopher. Unschooled, unskilled, he becomes capable, very often, of a tremendous integrity of penetration. We think of, for instance, a slave like Aesop, whose fables show an uncanny penetration. And yet all of these fables represent things which the average person could know, could understand, could experience, but he did. There is nothing involved that is beyond what might be known to a slave. But many slaves would not know it. Common sense represented then that Aesop was able to call upon this experience and find in it the common links with the experiences of innumerable other creatures like himself, some in slavery to a physical master and others in slavery to an ambition or a passion or a concept. Now, above the level of sense comes then the level of knowledge. Now, knowledge is more than sense, because a sense is a probability based upon experience. A knowledge goes beyond this. A knowledge implies a combination of actual attainment and a measure of experimentation. Therefore, we can say that knowledge could very well, Neoplatonically, be built upon the Baconian foundation, and Bacon followed Neoplatonism. Namely, that knowledge is built upon tradition, observation, experimentation. Tradition makes available to us a wealth of material that may or may not be knowledge, but supplies us with the raw materials relating to fields of endeavor that have been conquered or achieved by others. Therefore, tradition is actually the historical record of the experiences of other persons. This becomes a valid source of knowledge, but is not in itself knowledge. Therefore, to tradition we add observation. Observation causes the individual to observe the application of tradition to the contemporary events of living. He can see with his own eyes and feel upon his own skin the operation of certain laws, certain facts, and learns more and more to, therefore, censor tradition as to its validity or its lack of validity. Then he adds a third element, experimentation. And experimentation is the process of putting a belief to action and observing its consequence. Now, for no other form of knowledge is there an equal substitute. Because no matter how much we may believe or we may hope, we may fear or we may aspire, all things are subjected to the final test of application. And it is only when we have taken a tradition, observed the world around us, and the operations of these traditional factors, then subjected them to the laboratory technique of experimentation, either in our lives or on a scientific level, can we then affirm that we are in the possession of knowledge. Such knowledge as belongs to physical things can be usually tested by laws of physical matter. Knowledge relating to intellectual, moral, or spiritual matters must be tested by the laws of these levels, which may be various kinds of application in our own living. If we follow our own advice, we will know whether or not we will fall into the ditch. But we can continue to hold a poor idea forever and never know it is wrong unless we put it to work and watch it fail. That is why so many people with so many ideas seldom, if ever, apply them. They have a secret suspicion that they are not going to work, and they will not expose themselves to this situation. Now, above knowledge, we approach gradually to the highest levels of learning, and we come to that which is superior to knowledge, and that is wisdom. And in Neoplatonism, the term wisdom applies primarily to those who have as a motivation or a moving springboard to conduct a well-developed, contemplative internal life. Wisdom arises from the contemplation of knowledge. For knowledge in itself always tells more than itself, if it is valid. All things known have imponderable overtones. The moment we establish the fact of anything, we come into a vast field of implications relating to that fact, antecedent causes which must be presumed to exist, subsequent effects which must be assumed will follow. So the aura of knowledge extends from itself into the contemplation of principles. The moment, for example, that we become aware of the operation of a law, we are confronted with the necessity for the acceptance of a lawful universe. If water flows downhill, this is a fact which we can transform into knowledge, and through knowledge we can vitalize into utility by using this water to turn a wheel or something of that nature. But the moment we begin to contemplate this knowledge, it opens us to another world, a world of imponderables, which must exist in order to support the known fact. Because no fact stands alone. No knowledge is complete as a fragment. Therefore, the contemplation of law and order, the study of a snowflake or a crystal in a rock, the moment we contemplate knowledge and arrive at the inevitable conclusions that knowledge forces upon us, we verge toward wisdom. For wisdom is the creation of a setting in our understanding great enough to encircle all knowledge. For knowledge is suspended from principles, and these principles are its inevitable causes. So wisdom stands as a crowning power, and in wisdom we achieve that degree of development by means of which we are urged or moved toward the life of wisdom. For having observed, having rationally experienced, having reasonably demonstrated, we are inevitably impelled to a personal standard of conduct conformable with the level of wisdom which we have attained. Conduct on a level superior to wisdom cannot be maintained. Conduct on a level inferior to wisdom cannot be tolerated. Therefore, the attainment of wisdom is really the beginning of an internal dominance over externals. Wisdom causes the mind to move gradually and inevitably from an acceptance of effect to a recognition of cause, and causes us gradually to transfer our allegiance from particulars to principles. Thus, from understanding and wisdom, we come to gradually perceive the outlines of the intelligible deities, the conceivable realities that lie beyond mind. We have now ascended through the levels of body and the soul's three polarizations: its association with body, its association with itself, and its association with the world soul. And we have come to that point in the discipline of Neoplatonism, in which we stand on the threshold of a universe which has gradually enlarged, as it enlarged for Plato, as it enlarged for Plotinus, until at last we stand, as it were, upon the edge of a cliff, looking out into an infinity, and our road ends at the edge of the cliff. And there are only three choices possible to us: to retrace our steps, remain on the cliff, or jump into space. Any one of these three courses may be followed. But in all probability, as wisdom cannot be less than itself, we cannot go back. As wisdom will never be content to remain as it is, we cannot stay where we are. Therefore, the very demand of the pressure itself moves us inevitably towards this mysterious step into infinity. This step was the final exercise of Neoplatonism and was that division which is called theurgy. And theurgy is the individual coming face to face with the impossibility of the objective or philosophic or even contemplative attainment beyond wisdom. Now he has bridges, and Neoplatonism pointed these bridges out. While man is in ignorance, a glimmer of sense is within him. While he is sensible, a glimmer of knowledge shines within him. When he knows, a glimmer of wisdom shines within him. And when he goes beyond knowledge and beyond wisdom, a glimmer of something else shines in him. And this glimmering of something else is by means of a bridge or a kind of rational magnetic or auric field which surrounds the fact itself and which the Neoplatonists call inspiration or in some cases intuition. In other words, man begins to recognize beyond wisdom a new standard of knowledge. A standard of knowledge which is rooted in the substances of realities themselves. In other words, in the conceptual forms which he has called principles, and which the ancient Greeks called the gods. In the great orders and hierarchies of conceptual beings, the individual, having attained wisdom, becomes dimly aware of the magnificent blossoms that are floating in eternal being, like the lotus upon the surface of the water. And he realizes, as we all realize, finally, that the answer to every question that is vital and is real lies in this profundity, in this mysterious something that is forever beyond the grasp of the reason, that is forever beyond the power of the intellect to ordain or integrate. Then we come to the final step in the Neoplatonic concept. Namely, that man, having exhausted the potentials of soul, these having been exhausted because he has exhausted the potential of the world soul. Because the world soul is not identical with being, but is subordinate to it. Therefore, as being produces soul, soul is deficient in something, because the superior is always greater than the inferior, and the creator must always exceed his creation. So when we reach the extension, or the ultimate, of the rational soul through the cultivation of the highest aspects of contemplative wisdom, we have exhausted the power of the world soul to carry us further. We then stand as Moses stood, overlooking the promised land, but he could not enter. Therefore he lay down and died upon the lonely hills of Moab. And in the Neoplatonism, there comes the same crisis that Buddhism approaches in the mystery of the Nirvana. Namely, the transition between conditioned and unconditioned existence. And the only solution to every conditioned existence lies in the unconditioned, because only the unconditioned, moving above the level of mind, on the level of conceptual reality, possesses the absolute authority of creation. This authority does not lie in the mind of the deity, but in the will of the deity. Therefore, in a strange way, the will produces the mind. A man, having exhausted the mind, must therefore return to the contemplation of the power of the will, the power of the universal will, which does things because of inevitability. And all things created are right because they are inevitable, not because they are moral or immoral. The Neoplatonists then contemplated the possibility of man bridging this interval. And they came to two conclusions, one essentially the Egyptian and the other essentially the Greek. These two conclusions were, first, that man, by the supreme exercise of his own wisdom, could jump into the unknown as a possible action of self-extermination. The individual could destroy his individual existence. He cannot do it until he has exhausted its requirements. In other words, he cannot do it anywhere until he has transcended that existence totally. Having transcended it, he can choose to cast it aside. So that essentially there is a possibility that the Neoplatonists contemplated that the final act of wisdom is to cast oneself into the infinite. Now the second attitude, which is a little less extreme, and gradually gained favor, especially as we find it in the writings of Dionysus and the Pseudo-Dionysus, is the recognition that total being, or totality itself, being in itself the only infinite and the only completeness, that it is conceivable that totality can possess the individual, even though the individual can never possess totality. Therefore, that the ultimate state is the condition of absolute acceptance or absolute receptivity to being. And receptivity to being presupposes the complete extinction of not being within the self. Therefore, if the individual can outgrow his body, outgrow his emotions, outgrow his mind, so that he is no longer dependent upon them, and that they can no longer dominate his character. When the individual is no longer under the limitation of thought, he has therefore exhausted thought. He has exhausted the power of thought over him. The Neoplatonist contemplates this problem. When the individual has outgrown thought, what is left? When he has exhausted mind, and until mind ceases, because it can no longer contribute anything, and mind has to have constant motion for its survival. The mind only lives because it eats the unknown, lives upon the unknown, stretching out, consuming it, transforming the unknown into mental food. When the mind has devoured all of the unknown, when the mind would be forced to reach a stasis and remain the same forever, then the mind would cease. So one school, the mystical school, assumed that the individual who has outgrown the mind and can cast it aside, as he casts the body aside, is then capable of the total experience of being. Now, Neoplatonism does not assume that this total experience of being is going to be bestowed upon individuals in daily living. It assumes that this total experience is going to be bestowed only at the end of the entire process of growth. Now, the Neoplatonists, however, did have a particular and definite doctrine, namely, that at various stages in the transition periods, particularly through those transitions which relate to wisdom and move toward intuition, when man is reaching the rim of wisdom and his intuitive and apperceptive powers are beginning to grow, he may and does receive an occasional flash, an illumination, an apperception of that which lies beyond. In other words, they originated the concept of what we call the mystical experience. They recognized it as flashes of complete integrity, not constantly available, but possible to man under certain conditions. And that by these intuitive or inspirational occurrences, which Plotinus declared he had experienced six times during his life, the individual becomes for a moment aware of some phase or attribute of being, not being in total, but something superior to his present condition. And because such superiority transcends that which is normally experienced, it may be mistaken for an ultimate, but it is not an ultimate. In the mystical experiences related by Plotinus and other Neoplatonists, one particular and interesting element is always present, namely that these experiences present an effulgent revelation of something that is in, around, about, and an essential part of everything that exists. These experiences did not relate to motion. They did not bestow a particular knowledge of any subject. They did not answer any question. In a strange way, beyond our concept of dimension, they simply answered question as it is. Not a question, but the entire mystery of question. They bestowed the seal of certitude, a tremendous authority blazing through the things intellectually or intelligibly comprehended or apperceived. So that suddenly an eternal value or eternal quality bursts through the universe. Man incapable of sustaining the tremendous pressure of this upon himself has only a second or a moment of this experience. And Plotinus was convinced that if it was extended for any length of time, it would consume the individual completely. It would destroy all of the sensitive cords of contact between the various parts of man's psychic nature, because it is too powerful. It is like Zeus appearing in the full panoply of power. It was too much. But through it dimly, the Neoplatonist perceived the reality, being, as an indescribable ocean of fullness in which all things were absolutely and completely sufficient, and that everything, in some mysterious way, was permeated with this sufficiency, with this ultimate, so that out of the flower in the field, out of the bird in the air, there was suddenly released a sense of absolute integrity of ultimates. The complete certitude of that bird's flight became a dynamic truth in itself. And in the same way, the certitude of man's immortality was impressed upon his own inner life. The certitude, or the seal, as Bamy calls it, of the inevitability of all things by nature good and inevitable, suddenly, with complete assumption of authority, forced upon the awareness of man, bursting upon him, so that all he could actually do is to inwardly accept unconditionedly the fullness of this implication. To this, Plotinus gave the name illumination. And this illumination was the ultimate reward of theurgy. It was the individual, having practiced and perfected those divine disciplines by which the individual consciousness, with its entire psychic life, is moved from a crude and barbarous state gradually towards a human destiny, elevated to an heroic estate, and finally restored in effulgency to the gods, and by the gods themselves returned to the Father fountain of all things. Thus the ascent of the soul is by a kind of ladder, a ladder of attainment. And Neoplatonism pointed out that this was not a theological ladder primarily, but a ladder of merited attainment every step of the way. And that this ladder of merited attainment was man's justification. It was his witnessing of his own resolution to grow. He proved his merit by his consecration to the proper and sequential steps of growth. on and up to the ultimate end to be attained. Now, I said earlier that this concept had a profound effect. It had a very profound effect for the simple reason that in its final contact with the rising church of Christendom, Neoplatonism was officially destroyed. With the death of Hypatia, the martyrdom of Hypatia, the school in Alexandria ceased. And with the final edict of Justinian, the Greek schools were closed. But the early church took into itself practically the entire concept of Neoplatonism. And Neoplatonism became the philosophy of the church for 1,200 years. It became the philosophy of St. Thomas Aquinas. It became the philosophy of St. Augustine. It became the basis of the meditational and visionary theories of St. Bernard, of St. Buenaventura. It inspired the entire mystical life of St. Francis de Assisi. And gradually, moving forward, did the one thing that no one expected it to do. It turned men's minds ultimately from theology to economics. And in the 17th century, under the great revival of the Cambridge Platonists, this very Neoplatonism, which had seemingly led to the renunciation of the world, set the foundation for what we call the scientific method of life. As we go through the series, we'll be able to explain more and more of how this operated. Until today, the average American citizen's thinking, in almost any subject in which that thinking is reasonably correct, that thinking is 90% Neoplatonic. As Emerson pointed out, all philosophy is Plato restated. And to a great degree, it is true of Neoplatonism rather than of the direct Platonism. Because our entire contact with Plato in Europe and the Near East for 1,000 years was through Neoplatonism. Thus, the very fact that we have a democratic form of government, that we have the common law, that we have law and equity, these things are based largely upon Neoplatonism. The fact that we have empiric medicine, the fact that we have laboratories to carry on scientific research, in infantile paralysis and heart problems. These things are the indirect outgrowth of the conditioning of the European mind during the medieval period by Neoplatonism. So while the system itself seemingly disappeared, it prepared the way for this concatenation of knowledge. It gave us the public school. Comenius, the father of the public school system, was a Neoplatonist. And it began the concept of a grade school, of high schools, colleges, and special institutions. It gave us the whole concept of a gradually, sequentially unfolding knowledge. It prepared also for most of the atomic and physical research of the present time, because the Platonic and Neoplatonic concepts of deity as life and energy were based, of course, upon the atomism of Democritus and Leucippus, and the atomic speculations of Socrates. All these things moved together. Neoplatonism carried them across, spread them, and diffused them. And our modern world, in those parts in which it is more or less civilized, and in those parts in which it has more or less of a good spirit, and is seeking to grow, is largely a Neoplatonic world. And most of the morality and ethics of Christendom is Neoplatonic. So the diffusion of this subject has been immense. We've only been able to lay a certain foundation for it at this time, but we think perhaps we better let it rest now until next week and give you a chance to sort of catch up and get everything organized. So we'll see you again next week.